Welcome, April 2022, to our monthly support call. We're the second day of a three-part series on learning how to feel. And there's also been a request to do the four-step Art of Fear method. I actually have four versions of that. So I just whatever one I use is dependent upon where the group is or where the individual is. And then there's been three questions that were submitted. But first I thought that I would outline why are we having these calls. And for a while there, I was making them Dharma talks or about Zen in general. And then somebody said, hey, I signed up with these for these because I wanted to explore my relationship with fear. I'm like, ooh, good point. So I want to keep them on target for that. And of course I will always answer other questions unrelated to, you know, fear, but I think that for the most part, most people submit questions about fear. So I thought I would just address why do we need to have a relationship with fear? And it's because it's such a big part of our lives. And if we don't have a relationship with it, it's like living with somebody that is in your life pretty much all the time who you're just spending a lot of energy ignoring. So we don't want to ignore the big elephant in the room. Another question is, how is fear connected to your life situation? I will say that if you have any kind of problem in your life, it could be emotional, it could be physical, like aches or pains, it could be mental, it could be spiritual, it could be relationship, it could be blame, it could be underperforming, it could be procrastination, and on and on and on. Your relationship with fear either has something or everything to do with it, or specifically your unwillingness to feel fear. You know, if you have that, you're going to have a problem in your life, and it could be any one of 8 billion problems. So if you have a problem in your life, it's related to fear. So if you don't have problems with fear, then you're probably going to be a lot healthier. Next question. How is a fear practice a missing link to resolving issues and also unlocking growth? Well, I just talked about how if you have an issue in your life, you know, getting back in flow with fear again will oftentimes either somewhat resolve it or completely resolve it. And it'll also unlock growth because there is no learning and growing without a willingness to feel fear, which expands your comfort zone. Now, you guys are here because you have a desire to dive deeper into the fear conversation. And the question could be too, how do you make progress? Well, you learn how to feel fear, which is why I'm doing a three-part series on fear. Actually, there's three parts to making progress with your relationship with fear. First of all, getting to know what your relationship is with fear and having that awareness. Second of all, I think the most important thing that you can do to make progress in having a healthy relationship with fear is to change your language about how you talk about fear, which is going to be hard to do because nobody else is doing this in the world. Everybody is talking in a derogatory way about fear. There's a lot of fear shaming. So getting to know your relationship with fear and then speaking about fear in a positive way is how you make progress. And the third way you make progress is you learn how to feel your fear instead of think about it or resist it. So that's why the three different months that we're looking into shifting from a mental approach to fear versus a physical approach to fear and learning how to feel it. So what does the journey look like? Well, the journey looks like just learning how to feel in general for some people. I always say you have to crawl sometimes before you can walk, before you can run. For some people, they just shift immediately into an intimate relationship with fear. For other people, there's a lot of resistance to feeling fear. The journey looks like something different to everyone. And so everyone that's on this call is in a different stage of progress on their journey towards having a healthy relationship with fear. How is this connected to the other personal work that you're probably doing? Well, that's a great question because he who chases two rabbits catches neither. Like if you have a fear practice, but you also have a gratitude practice, then they may be canceling each other out. And you may not be catching anything or having any resolution of problems. And so what I'm hoping people will do, and at some point I'll probably just bring it up, if you can modify like your gratitude practice or your breathing exercise or your meditation or cognitive behavioral therapy or whatever it is that you're doing for personal work, to include making friends with fear, then it can be a good connection. You know, that sometimes people do both and they catch neither is what I'm trying to say. So we want to make sure that it's connected to any other personal work that you're doing. So please submit questions about that and let me know what your personal work is, and we'll address them as the months go on. And then the last question is, how does having a fear practice correlate with my personal journey? I have said this many times, but your personal journey in life towards emotional, spiritual, physical, mental health is like your relationship with fear is the most important relationship of your life, and you want to make sure that it's the best relationship possible so that you have a personal journey that where you grow to your greatest potential, if that's your desire, or that you can completely meet your core values. And that's how having a fear practice correlates. It's like with that is core fear. If you can be in touch with your core fear, then you can be in touch with your core wound. You can be in touch with your core values, and you can make sure that you're on a personal journey that isn't in resistance to who you are, but in alignment with who you are. So any questions about that? All these questions. All right, I will move on to our three-part series. This is the second part of learning how to feel. And I'm going to have Amy keep tabs with who volunteers, but I want three volunteers. Specifically, I'm hoping that I can reach people who are having a hard time feeling fear. And also three volunteers who have worked with me before with regard to voice dialogue. So Amy, if you could compile a list of people to be in the hot seat while I'm talking. Now, here's why I'm making this a three-part series. It's because I'm just alarmed at how few of us can actually feel. You know, when I say, oh, you need to learn how to feel your fear, they're like, well, I don't know what that means, right? So for me, feeling fear is very easy. And it's like I could say to myself, oh, drop the stick, pick up the stick, I pick up the stick, right? For me, picking up the stick is easy, right? I just feel my fear. I just pick up the stick. It's literally that easy for me as picking up a stick. And probably why it feels that way is because I have a pretty good relationship with my body and I feel like I'm here to feel, you know? Is it an innate gift that I have? Is it a learned gift? I don't know. Maybe I came out of the womb just being really willing to feel or aligned with my five senses. Now, feeling is, of course, one of the senses, smell, touch, all that. So you have these five senses, right? And I can say to you, hey, smell the rose. And you're like, no problem, I can smell the rose. And it doesn't mean anything. You just smell the rose and then you have the experience with the rose. Or I can say, feel the fur of a kitty cat, right? And that's fine. It's easy to do. It's like externally you can feel things, you know? It's externally a sensory experience is no problem for most people. But when I say, okay, feel something that's internal, like an emotion, or if it's something that you don't want to feel, like feel a snake, right? You maybe say, I don't know how. And probably you say, I don't know how because you have issues with the snake. If I say, hey, feel your fear, you have issues with fear, right? Now, you don't say, though, I don't want to feel the snake. I don't want to feel fear. What people say instead is, I don't know how to feel the snake. I don't know how to feel the fear. I don't even know what you mean by feeling the fear, right? And from my perspective, they do this as a way to get out of having to do it. Now, it sounds kind of harsh, but it really is not, shouldn't be a difficult thing. You just feel the fear, right? You pick up the stick, you feel the snake. I don't know how to do it. You know, I don't know what you mean. So from where I sit, I mean, here's another analogy. Imagine a child where I say, hey, clean up your room. And the child says, well, I don't know how to clean up my room, right? I don't even know what you mean, clean up my room, right? It's clear. It's just another way of saying basically, no, I don't want to, but it's a strange thing to say. And I get it though, that child, if they say that, likely has issues with cleaning their room, right? And if you say, I don't know how, likely you have issues with feeling fear, mostly because you haven't allowed yourself to feel it before because it feels uncomfortable. And prior to meeting me, you may have tried everything and had every excuse in the book to not feel it. You know, we have the list of payoffs that you have for not feeling it. You have the flight list, you know, all these habitual patterns on not having to feel it. And I come along and say, hey, just feel your fear. And this is your new excuse for not having to feel it, or your new way to not have to feel it, right? By saying, I don't know what you mean, or I don't know how. It's kind of interesting, huh? But that's what it looks like to me as a facilitator. So then I've been pondering, when people say this, I don't know how to, you know, I know how to feel a cat, I know how to feel or smell a rose, right? But I don't have, know how to feel my fear. You know, I see, like, what would I do with a kid, right, who acts like this, is what I've been pondering for this call tonight. So here's where I want to bring in my first volunteer. So who wants to be in the hot seat? And of course, I'm bringing up a big can of worms. Who wants to be in the hot seat?
Gary volunteered.
Look at what we do. Oh, where's Bill? Don't make me go first. You know, I...
Okay. Well, other than that, we'll have to voluntold someone.
So, you know,
Bill, save me.
Somebody who typically has a hard time feeling fear. Gary, do you have a hard time feeling fear?
No.
All right. Let's find somebody else.
Thank you.
I can go.
Who just said that? Bill?
Bill.
Okay. Okay, Bill. So I always want to meet people where they are. And like, okay, if I say to little Johnny, right, clean your room, I don't want to clean my room. Okay, little Johnny, pick up the stick, right? I don't want to pick up the stick. I don't know how to pick up the stick. Feel the snake or clean your room, whatever it is, right? I'm not going to just make people feel their fear, you know, or do any of these things. I'm going to, you know, a child, I'm going to talk with them about it. All right, you don't want to clean your room. So what we're going to do, Bill, is you're going to shift and be in the voice of not knowing how to feel fear.
Okay.
Who are you speaking to?
Confused about fear.
Okay, confused about fear. Now, that's confused about fear. Is that what's more typical for you than not knowing how to feel fear? I'm asking because I asked to speak to the one who doesn't know how to feel fear, and you answered that you're the one that's confused about fear. So I assume that confused about fear is who would rather speak instead.
I think, yeah, what's here is I wonder, I'm not clear about how I'm in my relationship with fear. Sometimes I feel like I can feel it, and sometimes I feel like I miss the boat completely.
Okay. Allow me to speak to the one who misses the boat completely on how to feel fear. Who am I speaking to?
The one who misses the boat completely.
On how to feel fear.
On how to feel fear.
All right. So, and you're confusing to him, I'm sure, and missing the boat. Let me just try what this feels like for me. Missing the boat completely on how to feel fear. All right. When I facilitate a voice that I don't possess, it's hard for me to facilitate, so I'll do the best I can. What do you offer, Bill? When you show up, like, I just don't know how to do this, I'm totally missing the boat. What do you offer, Bill?
A break from feeling fear.
Okay. Interesting. Does the self want a break from feeling fear?
Yeah, he feels like he's dominated by fear, and he's afraid of everything all the time.
Yeah, fear's afraid of everything all the time. And afraid is just one way that fear manifests, but it seems like it's probably the way that it manifests the most for Bill. So when you show up, he just throws up his hands in the air and says, all right, that's it, can't do it, right? Like, I'm totally missing the boat. And you offer him an opportunity to not have to deal with it.
Yeah.
That's your wisdom.
Yeah.
And the question, of course, does the self want to feel fear? No, is the truth of where you come from. And when the self doesn't want to feel fear, you show up and you offer him that separation. Mm-hmm. So every voice has a wisdom and a delusion. That's your wisdom. What's the cost of you showing up to Bill's life?
He doesn't really get clear on what serves him, what makes him happy, what really to do to fulfill his purpose.
All right, let me just try that on. I think what you're saying is, and I see this a lot, when people don't want to feel fear, they lose the ability to feel pretty much anything else. You know, like the payoff is I don't have to deal with fear if you show up, but the cost is when you show up, he doesn't get to feel anything. And he doesn't get to live his life's perfect purpose, and he doesn't get to step out of his comfort zone. Like there's a lot of costs when you show up.
Yep.
Right? And we're going to explore love in a little bit. Like he even loses his ability to feel love. It's like, okay, he can feel things externally, but he can't feel anything internally when you're around.
Yep.
Is the payoff that you offer, Bill, greater than the cost?
Is the payoff greater?
Yeah. Like he's getting a lot out of having you around. Like, don't know how to feel fear, completely missing the boat, right? Bill's like, oh, thank God. And I don't have to feel fear. Right. But there's also the cost. Oh, I don't get to feel anything else. And I don't get to expand to my greatest potential. So there's a payoff and there's a cost. And I find that when the payoff is greater than the cost, then he keeps you around. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But if the cost is greater than the payoff, then he's like, okay, I need to learn how to feel fear and you're not going to help me do that. So where are we with Bill?
Bill is wanting to move past seeing the cost as being higher than the payoff.
Well, here's where we bow to you and say thank you for your service to protecting Bill from having to feel fear, right? And all that you've offered him. But if you look at him, he wants to have a different experience other than you.
Yeah.
Allow me, please, to speak to the one who does know how to feel fear. Who am I speaking to?
I'm the one that knows how to feel fear.
How big of a role do you play in Bill's life?
Bigger and bigger as of late.
Oh, well, that's handy. You were atrophied before, but you're saying now you're playing a bigger and bigger role. But we also know that the self has an issue with fear. He says he's scared all the time, or that fear's scared all the time. There's some judgment there. And so what is your relationship with Bill? Does he like you? Does he appreciate you?
He's, I think, a little confused by me, used to not picking me up, but is committed to.
So you're the one that isn't trying to feel fear. You're the one who knows how to feel fear. And he's confused by you. And are you confused as the one who does know how to feel fear?
No.
Okay.
No.
I mean, the confusion may be another way to get out of feeling his fear. Because he has an issue with fear, right? But you've never been gone. Like the Buddha's famous for saying a lot of things. One thing he's famous for saying is that we possess in us all the wisdom to be anything or do anything that we want to do. And so you may be a little atrophied, right? You may not be familiar. You know, it's not that you don't exist. It's just that you're not familiar. But if we just tap into you, you know, can you be simple, or are you complicated? Like, Tell me more about you when you do show up.
Bill finds it surprisingly simple, and there's a real connection.
And there's no asking why or how when you're around. So give him some advice. What do you, well, it's you that feels the fear, right? He's just along for the ride. Maybe give yourself some advice. You know, how can you become a bigger part of Bill's life?
Yeah, what's showing up is Bill's habit of staying numbed out or checked out to the depth of fear. And so when he and I really connect, it's surprising to him that suddenly fear is very present around an issue that he hasn't been able to get clarity on.
And you are the bridge that he can cross in order to feel it, connect with it, and listen to its wisdom. I always talk about how fear is a great, or a very useful tool for decision-making. You know, he taps into fear, he taps into intuition and instinct and gut feelings, things like that. He's afraid if he does something, he's afraid if he doesn't. You know, you have something to say about all of it. So I think that, you know, like my next question was going to be, what's your wisdom? And I think that what your wisdom is that he's the bridge that you're the bridge that he crosses to access wisdom, or the wisdom of fear, and the wisdom of being in flow with his emotions and what that offers him, and the wisdom of being willing to feel fear and what that offers him in terms of growth. But it starts with you. What's it going to take to make you more familiar to him?
I think it's his willingness to, I see him deepening in his ability to feel everything, including fear. I see him deepening in his willingness to feel pain. The body has had to teach him that. He's had to open up to pain through physical pain, through his body. And I see him doing that. And as that happens, he's opening up to other old pains that he's been repressing. So he learned along the way to repress his emotions, and including fear. And I think he's seeing the cost. So something's cracking him open. I don't know how to speed it up.
I think giving you a raise and taking action to helping you become more familiar to him is a long way. And if he can learn how to, through you, feel his fear, it's not even that he has to learn it. He already knows. You already know how to do it. It's like you don't have to learn how to feel a cat, right? Or smell a rose. You just do it. So it's like your wisdom that he possesses. And in doing so, he can also learn how to feel his pain, his emotional pain, which may or may not involve you, but probably does. He can learn how to be intimate with it all. And it may just be that he's habitually patterned to be really aligned with resistance to feeling fear. And then, of course, the new version, maybe somebody uses drugs or alcohol or staying really busy or being in their head all the time. That's the old version of resistance. The new version is, I don't know how to do this, right? What do you mean? That's the new resistance to feeling fear. And confusion, oh, I don't even know what that means. But it should be as simple as picking up a stick or cleaning your room, and you offer that. And it's just about making you more familiar and more of a commitment to you. And the thing is, people have issues with pain or fear, usually because they haven't allowed themselves to feel it in the past. And it's the same with love, right? Maybe somebody has issues with love only because they've been unwilling to feel it. But once you become willing to feel pain, once you become willing to feel fear and all of that, it's, you don't have issues with it anymore. It's just part of life. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Now I want to have another volunteer, somebody that's in their head a lot, or in their heads a lot, so that they don't have to feel. Do we have such a person? Gary, I may have to call upon you just to do this exercise if nobody's willing to be in the hot seat.
Yeah.
But before we get started,
I'll do it if you don't want to call on somebody. This is Mary, but I need to pull over. Sorry, give me one sec.
Well, Mary, you have a moment. So I'm going to read a quote from Charles Darwin. And this was a quote that I've been meaning to share with you guys, because when I saw it, I was like, oh, it's so beautiful. It's on his fading ability as he got older to find music, poetry, and art as emotionally evocative in his old age. And this, the source was the autobiography of Charles Darwin. He wrote, "My mind seems to have become a kind of machine for grinding general laws out of large collections of facts. And why this should have caused the atrophy of that part of the brain alone on which the higher tastes depend, I cannot conceive. A man with a mind more highly organized or better constituted than mine would not, I suppose, have thus suffered. And if I had to live my life again, I would have made a rule to read some poetry or listen to some music at least once every week. Perhaps the parts of my brain now atrophied would have thus been kept active through use. The loss of these tastes is a loss of happiness, and may possibly be injurious to the intellect and more probably to the moral character by enfeebling the emotional part of our nature." So basically he's saying, oh, I'm all about gathering facts and data, and so I've lost my ability to have access to my senses. So it's I think that the most
big smart he's one of my heroes.
What I missed that. What was that?
Darwin's a smart guy. He's one of my heroes, yeah.
Well, then it's appropriate that I have a quote of his.
I'm a scientist.
So I want you to, or you're pulled over, Mary, right?
Yeah.
All right. What's something in your car? Maybe focus on the, right? Focus on the dashboard.
Okay.
Right? Like, just grind out the facts, to borrow the Charles Darwin part of that quote. You know, focus on the facts of the dashboard. Like, focus on it. It's with your mind, right?
Yeah.
Now feel the dashboard. What's the difference?
Super different.
What's the difference?
There's texture in the dashboard. The thoughts are all in the front of my head, represented as a pressure in the front of my head.
So I was going to do this with a kitten or with like a rug or something. And my next question was, does shifting from focusing on it and kind of mulling over the facts of the dashboard to feeling the dashboard contribute to your happiness? I don't know if it's going to work, but.
Yeah, because it's tactile. So tactile is a different experience than thinking.
When we go skiing, if we focus on the skiing, or if we focus on technique versus feel into the skiing, or feel the mountain, or feel
yeah,
anything, right? It contributes to it. It's like we go together and just have a physical experience with things.
The other thing in my car is 2 surfboards. So I hear you.
All right. So I don't know if, like, here's another example, right? Now, if you can focus on like a drink that you're about to drink, and you've done this before, right? You focus on the drink and you grind out the facts. Like, what is this? This is water, you know, or maybe it's a cocktail. I went on vacation this weekend and had a lot of cocktails. Like, if you focus on the drink and you grind out the facts, like, what is this? What should I order? You know, that's one experience. That's you being in your head. But then if you taste the drink.
It's a much more spacious experience in, like, feeling the drink or touching the surfboard or the dashboard opens your whole mind. It feels like I can feel it in my head or my brain. And like, if you're thinking about something, it's all in one tiny part of your brain. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I'm overthinking it.
We could have this conversation like 500 times, 500 differences, or 500 ways in which it contributes to your happiness. So let's go internal, then. Because it's when you're talking about external things, and we're talking about kittens or the drink or what, you know, tasting the drink is going to be more happy than just focusing on it, or it's going to be very different. It's going to be physical, that's going to be sensory, right? Taste, touch, all of that. Let's go internal now. I want you to.
You don't go there, girl.
All right, focus on love. Focus on love. And maybe you conjure up somebody that you love, or maybe you don't. What's going on for you, Mary, when you focus on
love? Dad died Friday.
What's that?
My dad died Friday.
Oh, I'm glad I'm
done. I've lost my kids. Good. There's a reason we don't go inside. Let's stay outside. It's easier.
Yeah. Well, you can think about.
Okay. How about dad? He's been around.
Think about how much you love your dad. Think about it and focus on how much you love your dad. Or try to understand how much you love your dad. That's one experience. It's neck up, right? Now shift and feel how much you love your dad. What's the difference?
It's not accessible. It's accessible in moments, and then I just start crying. So I get sick of crying all the time. So I'm not into that all the time. I mean, it's happening. I cry sometimes.
Right.
But I'm not into touching it very often because you have to function.
Right. And I mean, maybe it's something that you do in the privacy of your own home. Something that nobody does when their dad dies because they don't want to deal with it and they go numb instead. And it's like in this, we can even have issues with love, you know, especially if the person or the thing that we love is no longer with us. And
with us in spirit.
Yeah.
I think that.
Said that again?
I said he's still with us in spirit. I think that.
Right. Well, grief is love having nowhere to go. If you can't tell this person, but you can, right? And if you feel it, you just immediately feel sadness. And I mean, in this way, people even have issues with feeling love.
Right. Love is love, nowhere to go.
Right, it's painful. It can be really painful. It's rare that it's just wonderful and makes us feel great because there's always the fear that's involved in it, you know. And if you feel love, and if you fully let yourself feel love, I mean, I went on a date with somebody recently, and I really liked this guy, and then he ghosted me, right? And then he didn't ghost me. He actually wrote me today, but I had a week of just like, how dare you, right? And it's just it's painful, right?
Totally.
So then maybe can you focus on versus feel sadness? Like, do you allow yourself to feel the sadness? And And maybe you don't want to go there because you're on a call, you're on the side of the road, you're driving. It's like you don't want to be that vulnerable in front of some strangers.
But yeah, definitely.
If you can, you can feel your sadness, you know, what's the difference between thinking about it or focusing on it or talking about it? Maybe just answer that.
I guess it's like, it's a release if you can feel it, and it's just nothing if you can't feel it. It's just numb.
But it doesn't go away. We all know that, right?
It comes and goes in waves, is my experience. It's not linear.
And I feel like there's like a whole bucket full of love and sadness that you have to feel with your dad's passing. And it's our job to make sure that we feel it so it doesn't weigh us down, you know? So the exercise, you know, we got off on a tangent. It's a really beautiful tangent. But the exercise is showing the difference between focusing on something, you know, like focusing, you know, if you focus on a kitten, you know, easy to do, if it's easy to feel the kitten. But when we're talking about a snake, you know, it's a little bit harder. Right? You know, fear or sadness might be the snake. So focus on the snake versus feel the snake. And I don't know how, I don't even know what you mean, right? We know how to feel a snake, right? We just don't want to do it. But now imagine if you're focusing on a snake and then you shift into feeling the snake or feeling your fear. Now, what would be the difference there?
It's even bigger than just your head. So like, yeah, it's like your whole body. It takes up your whole space in your whole body rather than just a part of your head. It takes your whole body, which is cool.
How does feeling fear or feeling a snake or feeling sadness contribute to your happiness?
It is way better because you're in the present, you're in the world, and the world is limited to like a short time in a physical body.
And you're going all the way with diving into the deep end of the truth of what you're feeling and who you are and what makes you feel alive. And I ask a lot of people, would you rather feel happy or would you rather feel alive? And out of probably 1,000 people I've asked, 2 said they'd rather feel happy. The other 998 said they'd rather feel alive because it includes happiness, but isn't influenced by it. So maybe the better question is, how does it contribute to your aliveness? And the wonderful thing about loved ones is that we're still here and we're so aware of the fact that we still exist. And where did our loved one go? And, you know, it's like, I've never felt more alive in my life than after I've lost a close friend or after I lost my dad. And
yeah.
If you're willing to feel everything, you know, that bucket of sadness and fear and maybe anger, if it's there, then it contributes to your aliveness quite a bit. And just your presence. And
yeah.
That's the, when people die, they leave us with
mm-hmm.
awareness of our own aliveness, if we're willing to feel our emotions instead of think about them or ignore them or go numb in the face of them. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Mary, or request?
No, that was cool. Although I argue there's a place for numbing if the pain gets too much, and it's not useful to judge yourself too harshly for that.
Yes. When I went through my year and a half of hell and my, you know, everybody in my life was either died or left, I went numb for quite some time. It's a way to get through something that's just a little bit too much.
Mm-hmm.
You just want to make sure that you don't stay numb all the time. And
you need. Yeah, you need to have a plan, or at least an intention to come out of it at some point or at multiple points within every day.
Yeah, and it's a lot of the reason why people have out-of-body experiences when they're going through a difficulty. It's a safety mechanism in the body. And at some point, though, it's definitely our job to deal with that bucket of emotion.
Pull out of the ditch. Yep. Have the practice toward the end of the pain, pulling out of the ditch. Yep.
But it's not for everybody and it's not for every day. But I think for the people on this call, it is for you all who have signed up for these, you know, monthly check-ins. But is it for every day? No.
No.
The second Tuesday of every month, though. We're up for it that day.
Popcorn, bed, movies, champagne. It's all okay.
Yep. The rest of them. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next month, we will go through the final part of getting out of your head and learning how to feel. We're also going to go over why current treatments for anxiety disorders and depression are making your anxiety and depression worse. So how to recognize what's making it worse that may be invisible to you, and also how to prevent your kids from continuing the trend of dealing with their emotions the way that's primarily taught in society, leading to depression and anxiety in them as well. So any questions about what we just explored before I go on to three questions that have been submitted in the last 2 months? Okay. Doesn't look like anybody who submitted questions is on the call. So we'll have to make sure that they get the recording. Three questions were submitted. And if any of these resonate with any of you, speak up and I will answer the question for you, not just for the people that wrote them. So somebody wrote, I don't name names, I am disheartened by what I am feeling. I have a lot of self-loathing. This is depressing to me. It explains why I isolate myself. I feel that those who think positively of me are just fooled. I'm not quite sure what to do with that emotion. Now, just let me pause. So she's calling self-loathing an emotion. And I guess it would be an emotion if there's fear, anger, or sadness involved. But self-loathing, I see more as a core wound of some sort that's tied with a lot of fear and sadness, is my guess. She continues to write. She's baffled as to why I feel this way. I used to think it was just an inner critic, but it sounds and feels more like me just loathing myself. So self-loathing, if you notice, then there's subject object. This is me just speaking, self-loathing. It's like, what part of yourself do you loathe? Maybe a bigger question. Her question goes on for quite some time. I finally have my dream job and I'm loving it. 5 months of self-sabotaging and feeling like, 5 months later, and I'm self-sabotaging and feeling like removing myself from people every day. Something sucks away all my confidence and I want to run and hide. I've been dealing with this most of my adult life. The book has helped. I understand and respond in a more positive way when I start to feel myself, she wrote, slip. I've allowed myself to feel those negative feelings instead of kicking my hose and hoping they go away. It has helped, but is a daily struggle. Her final question was, what else can I do besides forcing a smile? If anybody can relate, and if you want to out yourself and put yourself in the hot seat, I'm ready to go. You have something that sucks away all your confidence, makes you want to run and hide. And if you don't want to be in the hot seat, then why don't we all do this together? And it could be around core wound. So it doesn't have to be around self-loathing. That's just her version of maybe core wound or some sort of stuck place. My first advice to her would be to stop forcing a smile. But of course, my core, number one core value is radical authenticity. So who am I to say? Because I could not force a smile. And if her number one core value is privacy, then maybe forcing a smile is what she needs to do. Or if her number one core value is positivity, then forcing a smile is also what she needs to do. But what she can do too is also go privately into a practice where she, and I mentioned at the beginning that we're going to go through the four-step art of fear method, and I have like four or five different versions of it. I want to introduce to you guys my new favorite version of it. And we can do it around self-loathing, or we can do it around fear. You can do it around just any part of yourself that you don't like. You know, what part of you do you loathe? So do this practice around that part of you that you loathe. And I'm just going to, for argument's sake, because she's going to listen to this recording later, I'm going to do it around self-loathing. So this is kind of a more of a five-step art of fear method. So start with resistance to self-loathing, or fill in the blank, whatever you're doing this practice with. So be in resistance to it and notice how that shows up. Like, I don't want to feel this. You know, I have, what was her word that she used? Slip, you know, when I slip into this state of being, you know, that's, I've fallen from grace. There's something wrong with me. You know, like I was doing just fine and now it's here and I hate it and I want it to go away, and just resist it. You know, have whatever conversation in your mind that is your traditional form of resistance. I don't want, I don't want, I don't want is mine. That's level one. Now I want you to notice, you know, have some awareness around where self-loathing or fill in the blank is for you. Just notice, is it in my mind? Is it in my body? Is it related to fear? Am I afraid of it? You know, sometimes it's not just noticing what it is, but also noticing your reaction to it, your relationship with it, your resistance to it. Just having some awareness about it being a person who lives in your body. You know, where do they live? Is it in your mind? Is it in your body? Is it in your chest, throat, lower back? For me, it's oftentimes right here in my nodes, I just realized. And then also noticing resistance to it, any kind of resistance patterns. You know, just going about my day, hoping it'll go away is her notice, right? So that's level two, that awareness. Next, shift into acceptance of self-loathing or fill in the blank. So I accept that this is a normal, natural part of life. I accept that core wounds were born with them, that I accept that I'm just the type of person who loathes myself, or specifically I loathe what, right? Like voices, I loathe insecurity, I loathe doubt, I loathe confusion. I loathe any kind of like not being great, but being insecure and feeling worthless, right? And now I'm accepting it. I'm accepting that this is just who I am. Sometimes I'm insecure. Sometimes I hate different parts of myself. Sometimes I think I'm ugly, I'm fat. You know, just accept that this is how you view yourself, and accept that these children, these voices are a part of your life and they're not going to go away no matter what you do. That can be really huge for people, the acceptance. Next level, fourth level, now we're going to embrace self-loathing. And embrace is another name for feel. We're just going to feel into our self-loathing or fill in the blank. So just feel the part of you that hates yourself. I'm saying this to the person who wrote in the question. Feel into it. I recommend doing this for at least a minute. Just feel it without trying to get rid of it. Now, this is not about turning up the dial. This is about just embracing it, like you would embrace a person. We all know how to embrace a person, right? We all know how to embrace a dog. The things that we typically don't like, we don't know how to embrace within ourselves. And I don't know how to do that, right? What do you mean? We're back to that again. You know how to do this. You've been embracing things your whole life. So embrace that part of you now. self-loathing. If you can find a way to love self-loathing or bow to it or feel it, honor it in this way, it's really a self-love practice. It's not about looking for the bonus of it or what it is here to offer us. You know, this is a lot simpler than that. This is just about feeling. And you may cry, because self-loathing has probably been in the basement for a long time, and it may cry. It has one of the crummiest jobs in this corporation. And oh my gosh, mom is now finally giving him or her some love. Of course it's going to be emotional. And then level 5 is intimacy with self-loathing or fill in the blank. And when you have intimacy with self-loathing, what just organically happens is it just doesn't, it's not that big of a deal anymore. It's self-loathing, right? Well, there it is again. And you may even have a sense of humor about it. And then you may even use it as a way to bond with other people. Like, oh God, sometimes I just hate myself so much. Oh, really? Me too. And then you have, with intimacy with self-loathing, you then have ability to have intimacy with another person or connection with another person. If you can connect with these voices that we typically want to have nothing to do with, right, then you can connect with yourself. And then finally, only then, are you really able to connect with others without just connecting through a fake smile. So here's a quote. American psychologist Carl Rogers, one of the founding fathers of psychotherapy research, said this: "The curious paradox is that if I can accept myself just as I am, then I can change." Now, I like this quote, but as you know, I have a history of modifying quotes. So the curious paradox is that if I can accept myself, which is only level 3, just as I am, like I accept that I loathe myself, then I can change. What if we took this quote and said, the curious paradox is that if I can embrace myself just as I am, then I can change. I don't even know if I like change. Let's just start with the first part. The curious paradox is that if I can have intimacy with myself just as I am, then I organically change. That's my modification of Carl Rogers' quote. I'll say it again. The curious paradox is that if I am with that, the curious paradox is that if I am intimate with myself just as I am, then I organically change. And you don't even have to do anything other than just feel or be intimate with that part of you. So that was working the 4-step, actually now 5-step, a modified version Art of Fear practice. Any questions about that?
I have a question. So I have a friend like this, and but they have the like convenient out of learning to be an alcoholic starting at age 12. So there's a shortcut. Mm-hmm. And it, so there's a person I see who wants to change but has given up drinking, and then eventually it just becomes too exhausting, and then they're back to drinking, and then they're back to self-loathing, and they're back to the thing. So do you have any suggestions for that kind of situation?
Usually that's people who want to change, and it's definitely a step away from, you know, there's like not wanting to change, then there's wanting to want to change. And then
but I've seen him want to change. He's gone sober like multiple times, even for 10 years at a stretch, but we still end up back here.
Well, there's still a payoff that he gets for having the alcohol in his life. The cost isn't big enough. And he's also unfamiliar with what to do. And he just doesn't have the tools to know how to deal with his unpleasant emotions. And so I mean, there's a lot of things going on there. There's huge payoff. There's, and maybe there's a payoff for him trying, but not succeeding, right? He maybe gets a lot of attention.
No, I don't think he wants it. I think he does want it to change, but eventually it gets too exhausting. I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe I'm giving him too much credit.
If you're fighting a war against 5,000 voices that you don't want to have anything to do with, that you've been medicating from having to fill, you know,
pretty much.
All of a sudden you have these 5,000 voices, you know, including self-doubt and fear and anger, what have you, that are like, you know, now out of the basement and screaming and yelling, but they're still stuck in their body, and he just doesn't know what to do with them. And so in these wars, and, you know, hand him my book, I guess, and get him on these calls.
I am again next time.
If you don't have the tools to learn how to deal with all of these difficult emotions.
Let me give you a tiny bit of context. He's also, for many years, I was 53 years old, was a substance abuse counselor and psychiatric nurse in the California state prison system, which probably added voices to the mix, frankly.
Well, I mean,
now back to alcohol.
Okay.
Not like he hasn't tried.
World.
He was 10 years sober at one point.
Okay. Well, okay. Here's what I recommend. And actually, I don't know if it was you that submitted this question, but the second question of the night is, can you comment on how to use the Art of Fear method to work with addictions and substance abuse disorders? That was you. Okay. So here we are. That was next. So let's go through the four steps together. And, or actually, I don't even need to lead you guys on this. I will just say, because unless somebody wants to be in the hot seat, like if somebody has problems with drugs and alcohol, is there anybody on the call that does, that wants to be led through the four steps with regard to drugs and alcohol? So the four steps, and I'll just outline it. The four steps are: step one, it's normal and natural to feel discomfort. Step two, what do I feel? Where do I feel? How strong is it? That's the discomfort. You know, that's the step two that identifies your discomfort. Step three, and this is where it really gets important to be on point for people who are addicts or substance abusers. Step three is where you recognize your resistance to it. The resistance is, yes, I want to drink alcohol, but it shows up as I want alcohol. I want drugs. I need drugs. I need alcohol. And there's something to be said for people having an addictive personality, which I don't have. So I don't know what that's like. I've had friends that were born with addictive personalities. I know American Indians have a genetic predisposition to having that.
Like what you skied when you were not younger. And that wasn't based off an addiction for like asthma and addictive personality. I mean, and I'm not pushing you, but I'm pushing you a little bit, like, because I read your book and I was like, yeah, this girl, badass of all badasses. All those people I know have addictive personalities, and they're not addicted to drugs, but they're addicted to endorphins.
Yes, and that's a form of drug. But the second I saw that I was addicted and that it was unhealthy, I quit, and it was not hard to quit. I think that's And, you know, you guys don't know this, but I was a partier in high school. And I smoked pot every single day in junior high. Now, I was 13, 14 years old. I drank alcohol. I didn't drink a lot. And one day I woke up and I'm like, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore. And I quit smoking pot and drinking alcohol when I was 14 years old. So it was not a problem. And then I also was heavily into cocaine up until I was probably 15 through 18. And we're talking every day one summer when I was 18 years old. And then I moved to Utah and I'm like, yeah, I'm not gonna do that anymore. And I quit it on a dime and it was no big deal. So I don't have an addictive personality, but I am drawn to altered states. I am drawn to bigger experiences. You know, the cocaine definitely was an ego trip. Like, I'm drawn to ego trips. Like, that's what cocaine offers you. But I don't get addicted to these things. And I feel like I can comment on what to do. to a point, because there is a penchant for people to have, and I think they can even identify it in a 23andMe study. I'm not sure about that, but I know that it's in people's nature on step three to really want drugs and alcohol, you know, or fill in the blank, gambling, sex, adrenaline, you know, and it feels like the weight of the world. It's like you want them so bad, like you want oxygen, you know, when you're drowning. So I can't comment on that, but I feel like the third step is where people who are addicts or want drugs or alcohol will probably get the most benefit, where they just feel into their resistance to feeling discomfort. And they just spend some time here just feeling it, feeling their resistance to the discomfort and their desire to take drugs or drink alcohol. So what that voice would be is, I want drugs and alcohol. I don't want to feel this. Those two voices, that's step three. Just sit with, I want drugs and alcohol, and I don't want to feel uncomfortable, and I want them now, and I need them, and I want them, and I need them, and I want them, and I need them, so that I don't have to deal with this, and I want them, and I need them. And just spending a lot of time there, just wanting them, not acting on it, but just feeling into it. And I would imagine that somebody, I would love if somebody that has a drug or alcohol problem were to call me up to work with them, because.
Okay, fine. I'm here. You want to work with me? You don't get an alcoholic boyfriend if you're not drinking hard.
Oh, okay.
You want to do it on the call? We can do it.
Well, okay.
It's just going to volunteer again. Get bored.
Okay. So then let's just make this a one-step art of fear practice. Just sit for 1 minute, and everybody can fill in the blank, like sugar, maybe, really want sugar, or love, you know, like if you're a love junkie, or sex, or, I mean, if you
want. No, it's alcohol, let's be clear. There's no sex or weird shit. Just champagne.
Okay, because I want to include the other people on the call, right?
Okay, perfect.
Everybody think of something that you want, that you need, that you're just like, you know, feel you deserve, that you, you know, that you is a way, if you were to get it, it could be validation. It could be like back rub, like whatever, something that you want.
No, I want to numb out. I want to like not have to deal with my emotions. That's the point of alcohol.
I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the other people on the call. Okay. I'm just trying to bring them into the experience. All right. So you are going to be thinking about wanting drugs and alcohol, and everybody else on the call is going to be thinking about something they want. So let's all do this together. You ready? So just sit and feel into, I want it. I want it so bad. I need it. And this is not about turning up the dial on this or giving it a steroid injection. It's just about letting it speak, however it's showing up for you right now. I want it. I need it. I want what I want. I need what I need. Whatever that thing is. For you, Mary, it's drugs, alcohol. Just want it. That's what it feels like. And whenever you want something, there's always something that it's like whenever you're running towards something, you're also running away from something. So add in also, I don't want. I don't want to deal with my discomfort. And it's also not about turning up the dial on that. It's just about meeting it where it is. What this looks like is, I don't want to have to deal with my discomfort. I don't want to have to deal with my embarrassment. I don't want to have to deal with my self-loathing. I don't want to have to deal with my fear. I don't want to have to deal with those 4,000 motherfuckers, those voices that are here to drag me down. I don't want that. I don't want that. I don't want that. I don't want to feel that. I don't want to deal with it. Instead, I need drugs and alcohol. So what happens when you do this is you're made aware of it. That's the first part. Second part is you realize there's separation between you and it. It's like subject, object, right? I, you know, want, yes, drugs and alcohol, but it's also the part of you that wants them is not you. Like you're Mary. And then there's this voice that wants drugs and alcohol, but it's not you. But you become very identified with that voice. And there's also a voice of, I don't want to deal with these 10,000 or these 5,000 voices that are uncomfortable. So when you do this practice, the four step art of fear practice, there's always subject object. It's like letting that part of you speak, those two parts of you in this case. And you're the observer. And by embracing it, it's not indulging it, it's just giving it a hug. And when you have like a child that's upset and you give them a hug, and maybe they're upset about something that you don't think they should be upset about, or want something that you don't think they should want, but like that's what a good parent does. You just hug them and you just give them support and just let them be. It'll work itself out. What was that like for you, Mary?
I was just, no, it's good. That's good. It's good guidance. It's good guidance. It doesn't always happen in the day-to-day life, but that's where there's grace. Yeah.
It's always about just being where you are and embracing. Like, oh my God, I am jonesing for drugs and alcohol. I'm jonesing for a cookie. I'm jonesing for validation.
For the record, I don't do any drugs. It's only alcohol, but it is a drug. I get it. I just want on the record, given my divorce, like I'm not into any drugs other than alcohol.
Yeah.
Not that it's any better, but, and I get it, but sometimes it just gets like too compelling or too like, ugh, you get sick of doing the work. You know what I mean? Especially if you work hard in many other areas of your life, like you're, especially if you're, you kind of started out this way of like, okay, you know, I'm doing so well. I'm pushing so hard. I deserve a break. That becomes the narrative, you know?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And you're perfect and you're trying to be like, okay, well, just give yourself grace in daily life. But if you've been conditioned since day one to never give yourself grace in daily life, that is a really, that requires a lot of practice by the time you've reached age 50 to just quit overachieving. You know, it's this kind of overachievement rebound cycle, you know?
Right, a rebellion against that. Like, I just want to relax and just live my life.
Exactly. It's totally a rebellion. It's like, okay, I'll do you for a bit here, but then I'm ready to just have a break and do me.
So then that could be your step three too. Like, I just want a break. I don't want to have to work so hard. I just want a break. I don't want to have to work so hard. And sitting with that feeling, you know, it's not you, you're not it, but can you just embrace it? It doesn't mean you have to act on it, but you know, it's always comes back to, and I mentioned at the beginning, I have like four versions of the Art of Fear method, and probably the most succinct one is, what am I feeling, right? I'm just over it and I just want to drink. Okay. And then you have intimacy with that. Two-step Art of Fear method. Okay. I'm just going to be over it and really, really want alcohol. But if you take a moment to just sit with it, what happens is any voice, once you give it some love and attention, and you know, you think that that means that you then go get a drink, but really, if you just spend some time with it as a person, you know, like a friend of yours, it's like, hey, let's have a drink. Okay, let's sit here and want to have a drink together, right? And you just wait. It may let go of you. It usually does. It's like that old thing with people that are on a diet, like you want to have a cookie, right? Just go and do something else for a minute and it may leave you. So, but I think that the thing to do is not deny that you want a cookie, but actually fully embrace that you want a cookie or fully embrace that you want the alcohol, and then it lets go of you. And so that's how I found it to be with fear. That's how I found it to be with anger. And then almost anything, self-loathing, all of that.
It's easier with an addictive personality is it just keeps coming back. Like it's so conditioned and it's like neurologically, you know, kind of fired up. So it just comes back all the time. And then you're like, oh yeah, I can quit. I can be fine without it. But then you're like, right. Fuck this. I'm fucking tired. I don't want to be Little Miss Perfect anymore. it comes back. So it's very insidious that way. I feel like it is kind of like the devil's teat or whatever.
Yes, it is. And of course, if you go to reach for a cookie and you deny yourself the cookie, then you become consumed with that cookie, right?
Exactly. So, right. But if you start that with alcohol and you have a hardcore alcohol problem, like where I don't feel like I'm in that, I definitely like use it, but like I have my friends like, boom, it's like you're going on a crash course.
So then it would be a practice for you just sitting and really wanting alcohol and really wanting alcohol and really wanting alcohol and really wanting alcohol. And then you get up and go about your life and let go of you. But then 5 minutes later, it's back and you just sit again. I really want alcohol. I really want alcohol. And if you do this for a month and if it's still there, then ask what to do next. But you have to do this practice, Mary, without trying to get rid of that need for wanting alcohol. Like see it as a person that's just like screaming in your ear, always there, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. And it's you just saying, all right, I wanna hear what you have to say. Let's hang out, let me hang out, and they calm down, right? They go away. And then you go do something and it's back, right? Okay, you again. So ask yourself, if that's a child of yours, what would a good mother do? You know, like let's say your child is an alcoholic. Mom, I want alcohol. Okay, let's just sit and want alcohol together. All right, I love you. Okay, in the moment.
I lost my children, so that makes it easier.
Right, and just keep doing it and keep doing it. It's not that it's foreign to not have that craving, it's just that it's unfamiliar. And so how you get there, the only way out is through. You've gotta go into your desire for alcohol and just keep going into it and keep going into it and keep going into it. And then it may let go of you. But the two rules of the game are you're not trying to get rid of this voice. You're not trying to shut this voice up. Because if you're doing that, it's too smart for that. And it's not about turning up the dial on it. And it's not about focusing on it. It's about feeling it. So those are the three rules. It's not about getting rid of it. It's not about turning up the dial on it. And it's not about focusing on it, it's about feeling it. You know, if you can just sit and feel it, not think about it, but feel it and embrace it wherever it is at that time.
That's useful for the addiction component, I think. I think it might be really useful to be like, kind of get in your body about it and be like, yeah. Where exactly is this localized?
Yeah. If it's in your mind, it's this, the third step isn't going to work. So anyway, we're going to move on because we've kind of run out of time, but it's about feeling it, feeling it, feeling it, feeling it, feeling it, having intimacy with it. And then all of a sudden there's room for something else to enter besides it. So just practice it, right? Thank you for bringing that up. It's very interesting. So last question. This is a really fast one. It's about skiing. Skiing the steeps. I can't seem to keep my torso in the fall line because I get scared. I keep wondering how to use your technique to improve mine. My friends are better than I am and I want to improve. The key to skiing, fear doesn't hold anybody back from doing anything. It is not fear that's keeping your torso from being in the fall line. It's your unwillingness to feel fear that is keeping your torso from being in the fall line. But if you become willing to feel fear, then your torso will naturally be in the fall line and you will improve your skiing because that has to happen first. And that's it. Be willing to feel fear and your torso will just automatically go in the fall line. All right, we have gone quite far past our time, but I always want to leave the door open to any other questions or comments. Anybody?
And we can send in for next month. Yes. Do you know the date for next month?
It's the second Tuesday of the month.
Second Tuesday. All right. Right, right.
Anything else? Big topics today. Oh, love the heart. Bye, you guys. Thank you for engaging consciousness practice with me today. Shift
Bye, mahalo.
To feeling, and just things get so much easier. And that's it. Till next month.
Thank you.